We're out in nature.
There's so much nature right now. It's.
I don't know if people can hear the nature.
I don't think they can. It's probably a pointless observation to make. But yes, we are in nature. We're in lovely Murphy, North Carolina.
We are. Point is that you may hear a bird chirp.
Yeah.
Or
the gentle babble of a rolling brook.
Or down
the lane.
The soft, gentle rustling of fallen leaves.
The high-pitched shriek of an attacking eagle.
Or a herd of turkey, which scare off. It scared the shit out of me. There was about eight.
Jeff was out accosting turkey this morning.
I was not accosting anything. I was actually trying to rapidly return to the house. And in my rapid return, spooked.
Yes.
I don't know, a gaggle? It's not a herd of turkey. Herd, that sounds ridiculous.
It's a murder of crows. I know that one.
Yeah. It's an embarrassment of koalas.
Wait, no, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Are you fucking serious?
I swear, yeah.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. But this is an embarrassment.
Embarrassment of koalas.
Is that just because the first time it was coined, because there was just so many koalas, he was just like, this is embarrassing. I'm so sorry. Like, there is just way too many koalas. I am so appalled.
Some British dignitary was there trying to show the Queen of England on her initial voyage, and she showed up to show one koala, and there was a bunch, and he goes...
That's amazing.
Her Majesty, I'm embarrassed by the number of koalas that are here.
This is a shame to the throne.
It is.
No koalas in North Carolina.
No, not
unfortunately.
Anymore.
God,
it would be lovely, wouldn't it be great?
I wish I had a koala sitting in my
We should
lap
plant
right
a
now.
Bunch of eucalyptus trees all around this property on the off chance that a stray koala happens onto our property.
Australia is not that far away.
It's not.
From North Carolina.
Not really.
It's really not.
It's no further.
It's just a little jaunt over the pond, right?
Multiple ponds. A couple ponds.
I mean, it's only like three continents away.
It's literally as far away as you could possibly get.
I mean, whatever. I we can dream, though.
We can dream.
So
there will be no koalas, sadly.
Very sad.
And after that tangent, we still don't know what a group of turkey are.
No, they're isn't it gaggle? I think it's gaggle. Right?
It's a gaggle of geese.
It's a gaggle of geese. It's a fucking shitload of turkeys.
It's a lot of turkeys.
It's a waddle.
A waddle of turkey?
Isn't that what?
That sounds fairly official.
Isn't waddle is something associated with turkeys, right? Is a waddle the thing that hangs?
Yes, maybe that's the thing that hangs.
Is that the thing? Yeah. I think that's what they
the
should
thing
be
that hangs.
The thing that hangs from the turkey's chin.
For a podcast, the thing that hangs, it could
be
anything.
Shit. See, this is how long it's been.
I know.
I'm doing the visual gags for the podcast.
Hey, it fit right in for me. I was all over it. So yeah, we're here in Murphy. What's the temperature? Right at just above 50 degrees.
A brisk.
Overcast. I feel like I'm doing a weather podcast.
I know. We've changed the format. We no longer talk about films.
We talk about the current weather. We sit in random spots
and make banal observations about our surroundings. That's what we do now. So I hope.
Oh, there's a caterpillar.
The sad thing is that I looked. I just looked for the caterpillar.
Oh, there's a caterpillar.
I'm, dude, okay.
I couldn't think of anything more banal than a leaf.
Look at that caterpillar race past.
Wow. Inchworm moving at centimeters per per hour.
Oh, man.
We're here.
And it's been a minute, right?
It has been a minute. It's been approximately... Oh, I don't know. What,
a
month?
It's been a couple months.
Month and a half?
Yeah, month and a half.
Oh, we're at the end of February. Christmas. Yeah, so two and
Since
a half
Christmas.
Months.
And I think we dropped the ball so bad.
Oh, we just abandoned ship.
We didn't even release a Christmas episode.
No, we did.
No, we didn't.
Jingle All the Way.
That wasn't, I mean, on Christmas Day.
Oh, right.
In fact, we actually did record.
We did
an episode, but we jettisoned it.
It was because it was an abomination.
It was probably the worst episode of podcasting that's ever been executed, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, because
there's a lot of podcasts.
There's a lot, but we took the
crown
on that one.
It was just, I feel like we're just like, yeah, let's go do it. Let's go do it, man.
Let's do
and
it.
And we went and we just, it was.
And it felt that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
The level of the attention to detail really came through.
There was no, yeah, there. It was the least organic conversation that ever happened between two people.
Yeah.
And we decided to withhold it and not share it, to spare you really is the truth.
I agree. So, no one needs to listen to that.
Yeah, no, that's. We've spared our loyal listeners, and but we're back.
We're here.
We're back. Yeah, we're here. Maybe I shouldn't say we're back. We're here.
We're here.
We're here. That's
here's another episode.
Here's another episode of this podcast. We're here. It just happens to be in different surroundings, but it's been lots of. Just one of those times when, you know, not to get into details, but when life reminds
finds
you,
a way.
Life finds a way. When life, most of the time you're going around and life is just happening, and then some days it just stops and kicks you in the balls, and says, "Hey, remember me?
I'm life.
I'm here, and I can do this when I want to." And that's what happened, I think, for both of us, and we had to take a break. But you know what? We're committed.
I think you know, taking a 2-month break,
well,
right around Christmas, mm-hmm. is kind of like we're like a rich glitterati that jet set around the world, and they feel like they work hard, but they really don't.
Yeah.
And they take 2 months off and think,
Jeff and I, we went to Cabo.
To Cabo.
We had life was just getting to be too much. We abandoned our families and our lives. And it was because of the podcast. It wasn't because of life. It was like the podcast was just too stressful. It was just too much. It was too much responsibility.
I mean, these movies, they just keep coming.
Yeah, and we actually, this is the day that we returned to the United States, to Murphy, North Carolina. We just got back from Cabo. We're sitting.
Yes, we took an international flight into Murphy.
We haven't even contacted our families.
They
have no idea where we are. And so.
Well, they will once we release this podcast.
I guess. This is our way of, I'm single, so I don't know if Lexi will take you back at this point. It's zero contact for a month and a half.
Yeah, I mean, well.
I mean, it's pretty. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
But the point is, we're here for you, our loyal listeners.
Yes. Which, you know, my wife was one of them until I left her for a long period of time. So we're down one.
Can we
at least
do the? It's your wife, your wife's sisters, Casper Van Dien,
and
the family of William Hickey. They've been sitting five of them
waiting
have been sitting
with
William Hickey has one person in his family.
William Hickey has outlived his entire family.
Ironically, all of his children passed.
Yes, but Hickey's still here.
He's in a bunker somewhere. He's in a compound with Disney and
the
Elvis.
Blessing. Yeah, he's. Oh,
I can't wait till our next William Hickey joint. But that's not today.
Today,
what are we doing today?
Today we're on a movie that you love.
This is a joyous day. Because we get to talk about a truly joyous film, and I felt it was to ease the transition of coming back into the podcast. We should pick something just light and at least for me is the source of incredible amount of joy, and that is the 1987 masterpiece, Raising Arizona.
Right, Raising Arizona.
Yes, it's Raising Arizona.
Which I watched for the first time all the way through.
Which is astonishing.
This morning, actually.
Wow.
And
you're welcome.
Yeah.
Fucking welcome.
It is a good film that I like.
Okay. Okay, well, I'll take that. But wow. I had no superlatives. I was hoping for some superlatives here.
Well, I mean, I can give you some superlatives. I don't know that I would use them in this instance.
Oh my god. Oh boy.
I don't think I'm smart enough to understand this movie.
Oh my god. I'm sorry.
This is what typically happens when someone loves a movie as much as like they just like, oh, it's just a masterpiece, like you're saying, I'm like, it's a good movie. I go, I'm just not smart enough to understand what is so great about this movie. So
I mean, you're not, but don't get down about yourself. Not in this case. Wow. I mean, I have to say that about Raising Arizona to me is kind of
explain to me silly. What is it about the movie that you are so high on?
All right, so. For the uninitiated, for the unfortunate and uninitiated who don't know this film, as you didn't before this morning,
yes.
Raising Arizona is a film directed by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan. For my money, if we're talking auteur filmmakers, they're like the greatest.
Wait, well, hold on. Take a step back and define that word.
Another movie term, auteur, meaning films that are written and directed that are basically the singular expression of one filmmaker. So, Charlie Chaplin, that's an auteur. Woody Allen, that's an auteur. Paul Thomas Anderson, auteur. These are filmmakers who write and direct their own movies, who are kind of like, the whole thing is really from them. Like Scorsese or Spielberg, not necessarily in that category, because a lot of their, not all of them, but a lot of their projects are brought to them, and then they direct them. But auteurs originate their films. And the Coens,
Tarantino,
absolutely, Tarantino, okay. Total, okay. Absolutely auteur. The Coens are, I think, like the greatest American auteur filmmakers alive.
So, what are other movies that the Coen brothers?
I got one. It's coming. I'm sorry.
Greatest filmmakers.
The Big Lebowski, ooh, Fargo, wow. Okay. Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay, no Country for Old Men. Hold on. That's interesting you said. Okay, so I was about to say, did they do Oh Brother, Where Out There? Because this has a very Oh Brother, Where Out There feel, and I don't know if it's just because John Candy.
Oh, boy.
John Goodman is in it. Another large John.
large John.
Sorry, in my brain. Evidently, the John Candy, John
He's
Goodman
not so
connection.
Large anymore.
No,
He's
but a... John Candy, John Goodman, in my brain, yeah, the connection sure. is a long, large man. Yeah. So,
a jovial, joyful,
yes,
large man.
Yes.
I get
so,
jovial, joyful John.
Yes.
That's our
that's how good friends know
him. That's
our
side podcast we're doing.
Jovial, joyous. Oh,
anyway,
jaunty.
Back to the film.
Yeah, sorry, you were going. Okay, so auteurs.
Yes.
They're the greatest American auteurs.
Yes.
Filmmakers.
They're
and you were explaining the movie. So
and this is so this is the beginning of this is their second film. And the Coen brothers' first film was a movie called Blood Simple, which is kind of a famous sort of independent film in the sense that it came out in like the early mid-80s and they sort of came out of nowhere. And it's a very Blood Simple is a very different film from Raising Arizona. It is a down.
It sounds like it.
It is a dark, like film noir kind of with very unsavory characters. It's brilliant. It's an incredible. It's one of the best debut films ever. But it's very a wildly different movie from this. And so after Blood Simple, the Coens made a very deliberate choice to do as different a film as possible from their first movie with their second film as they could. And so Raising Arizona is kind of like the opposite of Blood Simple. It's sort of like Blood Simple is like the photo negative version of Raising Arizona. And basically the film is about a convict by the name of H.I. McDonough. Or High, played by Nicolas Cage, the great Nicolas Cage. Early in his career, I believe he's only like 21 years old when he made this movie.
Yeah, he looks it too.
Which is insane. But
shortly after Valley Girl, I assume.
Yeah, this was same year as Moonstruck. This was like the year that
the
Cage
okay.
rocket took off. Along with, by the way, Holly Hunter, who one of the great loves of my life, particularly in this movie, just. I'm so adorable, I can't handle it. But Holly Hunter, in this movie, also this year, did Broadcast News, okay. which is another incredible movie. So they both, these are two young actors at the start of their career who both just were taken off right now. And they star in the film as a couple. Nick Cage is a convict and named High, and Holly Hunter is Ed or Edwina, his the love of his life, who he meets in the lineup, or who he meets getting booked into prison.
Yep.
Repeatedly. He's a police officer. Yes, repeatedly, which we'll get to. But they fall in love, and they get married, and they want nothing more than to have a child, but unfortunately, they are unable to. And so they end up concocting this pretty absurd scheme to kidnap a baby, which is a quintuplet from the Arizona family. From of course Nathan Arizona, the unpainted furniture king.
Was that a thing? I'm just going to get back to. I don't. I'm going to stop you.
Yeah.
He is an unpainted furniture salesman. Yes. Which was that a thing?
I don't think it was.
No, I was going to say.
And I think that's the point.
Okay.
He has an empire, and like it's one of the funniest moments is when Nick Cage is like, and Nathan Arizona. Well, hell, you know who he is. And it's like, but anyway, so they kidnap his baby to make it their own because they figure, you know, he has more than he can handle. So. And that sets off triggers a series of antics and madness and insanity and hijinks and I love this fucking movie so much. It just makes me happy, this
okay.
movie. I think it's like I said, it's very different from Blood Simple, which is much more methodical and more sort of deliberate in its pacing. And this is basically just like a living cartoon of a movie. It's like they literally went the opposite direction where they were going to, every choice they make in this movie is for maximum comedic effect.
Right.
Everything they do with the camera, every line of dialogue, every performance, it's all made to be this explosion of comedy and kind of just energy.
Right.
And it's a bold choice in that way. It's a very bold move on their part, which I think is kind of, you know, like, you know, really exemplary of them, because, you know, Blood Simple was this big splash, and then to say, no, we're going to do something totally different,
right.
I think it's just, it's kind of like, that's, it showed that they're in their own lane, and
yeah.
they do their own thing.
Okay.
And I just, I mean, I don't know what to say other than this movie is, like, the opening of this movie, first of all, is one of the greatest, like, from the first shot to when the title music comes up
right.
of this movie, is just one of my favorite like chunks of cinema ever
okay.
done. It just makes me so happy the way it is constructed, which is Nick Cage getting, you know, meeting Holly Hunter as he's going into prison, and then it starts this long opening sequence where we see the beginning of the origin of their relationship and Nick Cage's troubles with the law and stuff. But the repetition of it and the calling back of things, and it's just, and the energy and how it just, it's because it's a really long opening. It's
yeah.
actually like, it's
was,
like 10 minutes or something.
I was surprised
the title
by that.
Comes up.
Yeah, because I was like, honestly, when I first started watching this first 10 minutes, I got into it, and I'm like, okay, we're in it. I'm like, all right, we're just going. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the title sequence came on, and I was like, oh, shit, that was just all before we even started the movie,
yep.
basically. So yeah, it caught me off guard, because I was like, wow, we're just going right into it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I liked the movie. It's okay.
You've
already threatened before we started recording that if I didn't like this movie, you'd end the podcast. So
I did.
We're back, guys,
well,
but only for this episode because it's on after this. It's not that I didn't like the movie.
Honestly, I would have you like committed.
I know.
If you didn't at least like this movie. Like,
it's a good movie, and the more you describe it, you know, as a cartoon, like as almost like I can see that.
Yeah.
A lot of characters in here are cartoony.
Yeah.
There's just visuals. It's. I'm gonna say something, and I need you to just breathe, okay? Because I'm gonna make a comparison to another movie that I know it is nothing like, but
hit me.
It, okay?
Hit me.
It's for me. It's kind of like when I watched Meet the Parents, and I was just uncomfortable through the whole thing, because he was wrong, like they're mad at him for the wrong reasons at Meet the Parents, like, and I'm like, it's not his fault, and like, right. Why are you being so mean? There's an element of this to where I'm watching him screw up all the time and them do all these things, and I'm like, that just doesn't make any sense. Why are you doing that? Just have a lovely life, Mr. Nick Cage.
I guess I should have seen this coming. The doesn't make sense question, which, again,
permeates on all of our podcasts.
In a movie where that need not apply, I think.
I struggle with these movies in which the humor is in this kind of absurdity. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like an absurdity where it's like it's shot as if it's a legitimate non-comedic film almost, but everything that's happening is comedic. Does that make sense? Like it's.
I not really. I gotta be honest. I don't agree with that assessment. I have to say, I don't.
Okay.
I don't think this movie is shot like a normal movie at all. Like at all. Okay. It is. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's right. Interesting.
No,
and again with the. I mean,
I'm just. I take that back. I just love it. I take all of that back.
But the Meet the Parents comparison didn't see that coming.
That's
I love,
more
once
me.
Again,
it's
these,
more me. It's this is an analogy in my head of my feelings. The connection is my feelings between these movies. They have no similarities. Maybe I don't find the humor as funny. Maybe that's why I don't.
It is a movie that is very bold in its style and very. And I can understand that if it is a little too much for you, it could rub you the wrong way because it's like that the entire way through.
Yeah.
And so if it's a little jarring for you, I can see that it would be a little bit hard to settle into it for the duration.
Right.
But I guess for me it's just so. I don't know. The Coens are like, what's so great about them is and this is maybe why you would struggle with their movies, is because they are not really concerned with plot or story.
No.
And their movies are very much about character and about behavior.
Yeah.
And really about style in a lot of ways, which I hate to say that because there's this horrible thing, which is style over substance, which people like to use, I think, just when a film's style just kind of takes them off guard and they don't know how to. But I mean, in some cases, it is style over substance. But anyway, in this case, I think
who did the Tenenbaums?
Wes Anderson.
Okay, Wes Anderson has a style that
he
he's got a like everyone knows his films, and I feel like
that
I can see where like it's a jarring to where it takes away or people think that it takes away from maybe the story he's telling, but it's actually more of a tool that is telling the story the way he wants to tell the story.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's just having a very distinct style and method for storytelling that they are using in this movie. And it's also there's something like one of the other things they tried to do with this is to write to contrast Blood Simple. They tried to write characters that were very sympathetic this time. Cause in Blood Simple, really none of the characters are very sympathetic, mm-hmm. but in this one, I mean, part of it is just Nick Cage and Holly Hunter.
You're right on the characters. The characters are amazing.
Yeah,
I love the characters. Every one of them is cartoony, but in kind of a fully fleshed out way. Like they're not, you know, they're all like, yeah. Nick Cage is this kind of screw up, you know, and Holly Hunter is this kind of by the book. And their relationship is improbable to begin with. And then John Goodman, Goodman, and his little brother.
William Forsythe
are his like...
Gale and Neville.
Yeah, are his prison buddies that have escaped.
Yes.
And they're you know, just pure... You know,
well,
I don't even know how to describe it. Their characters are fully formed,
right.
But like they're not. There's no conflict within them. They are who they are. Like there's no. You're not like none of these characters are Like even the dad of Nathan Arizona.
Trey Wilson.
You know, his son has been stolen from him, and he's in front of the reporters, right?
Yes.
And he's talking, but he's got all this bravado, yeah. And then at the end of which, he just makes a sales pitch.
It's business as usual down in Nathan. Unpainted Arizona.
Yeah. And, yes. And Unpainted Arizona, isn't Painted Arizona a thing?
I don't know.
I think it's a tourist. I think it's a tourist thing that they say.
I've never been to Arizona.
I've never been to Arizona either, but I think that it is Painted Arizona is like what they call Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Why don't you speak while I look it up?
This is, I've never heard of that, but yeah, I have been thinking more, especially because of the podcast, like because obviously I know that their initial intention was to just do something that was a total 180 from Blood Simple, but then I was also thinking about, okay, well, what else is at play here? And really, the movie is very much about parenting and parenthood, and part of me wonders if one or maybe even both of them were about to have kids or had just had kids, so maybe that was on their minds, because that's really what the movie is about. It's really about these two people who want to have a kid and end up getting a kind of crash course in an absurd, heightened way about, you know, all the, oh, painted the Painted Desert.
The Painted Desert in Arizona.
Okay, so that is a reference to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's the desert of the Badlands in the Four Corners area running from the east of the Grand Canyon. It's called the Painted Desert in Arizona.
Yeah. That,
so it's unpainted.
I'm sure, Arizona. Yeah, and I'm sure that is a reference to it. But yeah, I think this movie maybe was them taking some of their anxieties and stuff about being new parents and channeling it into this like over the top cartoony sort of movie. It's like David Lynch did Eraserhead, the Coens did Raising Arizona.
Well, I think one of my favorite early moments in the movie is they're stealing the baby. I know, but they're stealing the moment, the baby, and they're stealing the moment.
I stole the moment.
You stole the moment. They're stealing the baby, and they're driving off with it. And Holly Hunter just immediately starts going, I love him so much.
God, I can't. Oh my God, I could dedicate a whole podcast to how much I love her. She is so fucking amazing in this movie. But that's another, like, some of the choices that the actors make are so bold and I think they work beautifully. Right. Like that moment, and then there's another moment which is one of the craziest things I've ever seen any actor do. When it's in the middle of the chase scene, and she goes, "But we have a kid now. Everything's changed." And she like pulls this face. It's unbelievable.
Right.
It's like, but there are so many moments like that. And Nick Cage, his relationship with the Coens was difficult, actually.
Oh, really?
Making this
Why?
Movie, which is, well, because it seems like they would be great collaborators. It just seems to make sense, Nick Cage and the Coen brothers. But he had a difficult time, and he actually makes a good point, which is maybe why you and actually a lot of critics at the time struggled with this movie a little bit, which is that, you know, everybody now looking back on the history of the Coen brothers, we have their whole body of work to look at and say, well, yeah, Raising Arizona fits so it's perfect. It's a perfect example of it. It's like one of their best movies, because we have all these other stuff to compare it to. All Nick Cage had was Blood Simple. That's all he had. They had only done one movie, and it was a very different movie.
Right.
So he doesn't have the kind of trust that, like, because now actors will do their movies for free, not even
to
reading
do with
the script,
yeah,
because they're always so good, and because their writing is so good, and just to be in a Coen Brothers movie. But, you know, at the time, all he'd seen was Blood Simple,
right?
So he didn't have. It's understandable to think he's going into this kind of wild movie, a little bit not trusting their choices and their judgment on some of this stuff, because it's pretty big. And he didn't know what it was going to turn out to be.
Right.
So, like, they kind of, I think they had a respectful relationship, but he, I think his thing is because he's kind of a very, as you can imagine, he's a very hands-on actor and throws a lot of ideas in there and is always trying stuff, because he's one of the most inventive actors that's ever lived. But that was not met with a lot of sympathy from the Coens,
who
are very particular.
I was going to say, particular, I mean, one thing that I'm not a student of this, and I don't, you know, think about it. But when I think of Coen Brothers, when you listed off all those movies that are Coen Brothers, and to be fair, I wouldn't have known that those are Coen Brother movies, other than the fact that when I watched this movie, there were movies like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and a couple others that you mentioned, which I can't come off the top of my head. Yeah. that reminded me that this movie reminded me of those movies. And yeah. And one of the things that I think is common across all of those is the dialogue, is the language that the Coen brothers use. It's very specific, very brilliant, particular. Brilliant, you cannot... Yeah, the particularly the scene where Nick Cage is writing the letter to Holly Hunter that he's going to leave her.
Yeah.
And it's a beautifully written, and what I love about what the juxtaposition, I mean, this guy lives in a trailer park.
Yes.
He is recidivism is his name, according to the, the
repeat offender.
Repeat offender. you know, and so he clearly not a, well, he could be an educated man. Doesn't mean
he doesn't really use it to his advantage.
Right. But he writes this, I mean, it's a gorgeously written, like, letter.
Yeah.
Explaining like why he's leaving, which he promptly just oversleeps and never she never gets.
Yeah.
Which I did find funny because it's like this whole he like fell asleep writing his goodbye.
Yeah.
But it's just it was one of those things where it was like, wow, this is that part of the movie. I don't want to say that part of the movie, but that element of the film. I loved, which is there's this really, this juxtaposition of the narrative that Nick Cage's character is speaking that is very romantic, very erudite, very, you know, that language feels almost like something out of like an English, you know, novel kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but it's... in a trailer park about someone who stole a baby and is now trying to get the baby back. Yeah. The sequence where everyone falls in love with the baby and they're all going to raise the baby, that actually was very funny because it's like, it's like they're like, oh, now it's little Galen. Now it's little,
It's part of the, and that's kind of part of the charm of the movie in a way is that it really, it's like they put at the center of it a baby, which is like, it's the great, who couldn't fall in love with a baby? It's it's, and there's, at a certain point, it just like, and it's also interesting that, because Gale and Evel in particular, they kind of are just two giant babies. If you watch them in the movie, and I'm not even kidding, like that's kind of like, in fact, when they escape from prison, they emerge from the mud screaming if it's like a birthing scene. Yes, it really is. Yes. Like it's, I think that's intentional.
And John Goodman's just, like constantly, which was very...
And there are several moments where they are just screaming inconsolably for extended periods of time. There's even a moment where Nick Cage just lets out this kind of scream, almost like a baby. It's like it's like they're taking it to that level, I think. And you're exactly right with the way the dialogue. In fact, I was reading about kind of their inspirations for writing it, and like they were inspired by like William Faulkner and like Flannery O'Connor, who are like Southern writers. Right. So like, but also like they tried to, especially with High, put dialogue that he has like learned from other things, like the Bible or something. So he uses phrases that he's kind of picked up along the way, but that sound very, he's very well spoken and very, there's a, even though he's a terrible criminal, he has an integrity to him, and he's a lovable guy.
He has it's a Wile E. Coyote look.
Yes, and that was a Nick Cage choice.
It's like hair, the way he keeps his hair and his eye, he always looks like he's got a floppy ear.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know that I made the connection until you said cartoon, and then I was like, he kind of...
Yeah, that was one of the few choices he made that the Coens allowed, was that, he was like, he basically, Wile E. Coyote was like his inspiration for the character, and that's...
Well,
and he
pulls it off.
He plays it, right?
And then the Roadrunner would be
He has the tattoo, he has like the little... which also... Leonard Smalls, who's like the evil...
Who is that actor?
His name is Randall Tex Cobb.
Did he do anything
else?
He's
been in a lot of other... He's one of those guys who pops up. He was in The Golden Child. He was in...
Oh, that's where I know him from.
Ventura. Yeah.
He is the guy who serves the porridge.
Yes.
That's blood.
The bloody porridge,
oh my God, that scene. I just tried to explain this scene to somebody. Because we were talking about why I don't like oatmeal. And I'm... I'm serious. This is a real conversation. Someone said to me, they just love, it was my brother-in-law, it was Justin. He was talking to me how much he loves oatmeal in the morning. And I'm like, I hate oatmeal. And he's like, why do you hate oatmeal?
Because there's
and
blood in it.
I said, have you ever seen The Golden Child? And he was like, what? And I'm like, yeah, there's this whole scene where they serve bloody porridge to the Dalai Lama. And I'm like,
oh, God.
But that's the actor.
Yes, it okay. is. Yeah, no, he's been, yeah, he's been a lot
he
of
He also,
like
eats
things.
A butterfly in that movie.
Did he eat a butterfly? I remember him eating, he caught a fly.
Maybe.
He, like, catches the fly in front of his face, in front of, but yeah, he's...
All right, that's where he's from. Okay.
But he's got the same tattoo as him, and I feel like, yeah, that character was interesting.
Yeah, it was, but here, the whole thing, it's like the dream, like, sequence. I'm starting to like this movie a lot more now that I'm thinking about it, but yeah. You're not selling it. It's just I'm starting to think about it. I'm a processor.
I guarantee you next time you watch it, you're going to be like, this is one of my favorite
I'm a
movies.
Processor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm starting to like this movie a lot more now that I'm thinking about it, because the part that the element that I was kind of a fan of, the him being asleep, and it's like this is where I think of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. It's almost like a Greek myth type of thing,
yeah, yeah.
Which is like he's birthing. He talks about birthing or creating this like hellhound, right?
Yes.
Which is a very Greek kind of thing to try to suggest that like somehow through your bad deeds, you've brought some evil into the world as a counterbalance to something that you like as something that you did.
Right.
And
yes.
It's like, it creates this whole dichotomy of like now he has to like vanquish the hellhound he brought into the world to right to balance out the system type of thing. So it's like those elements along with the beautiful the exposition, the monologues part of Nick Cage.
Yeah.
Is a very beautiful, and it's a beautifully shot movie too. Yeah, there's a lot of scenes where you're just like,
as actually shot Barry Sonnenfeld shot it. He started off as a cinematographer. He shot the first Coen Brothers' first three movies, as well as When Harry Met Sally and a bunch of other movies. Okay. And then he went on to be a director. He actually directed Get Shorty and Men and the Addams Family and stuff.
All right,
but yeah, he shot it.
John Goodman's character, I really like. I like how he's a, I don't know, there's something about the way he talks, not just what he says, but there's a velvetiness to it. It's like a, he's got this deep voice, but the way he chooses to do it is almost sing-songy. It's almost like he's saying it lyrically, and in a way, and it's a joy to listen to. Sometimes I would get lost and not even hear what he was saying because I'm just like loving the tonality of how he was saying it.
Yeah, yeah. It's no wonder he ended up going on and doing so many movies with them because they it's just a perfect marriage.
Yeah,
he's and their writing. He's just so good at it. But I love their writing is truly. It's why they get so many great actors to do their movies because it's so specific and it's like. And that's why writers talk or actors talk about it a lot is that all the work is done for you on the page because it's all there. Like they are the best. They create characters through dialogue and through language. Like it's all like just in the way the character speaks, the entire character like comes from that.
The actor doesn't have to create anything.
So it's like it's like your job is already like you just got to come and say the words and like it's going to be great.
Right.
So and this is no exception and. There's just so many,
and the characters are really great, though.
Yeah,
do you know what I'm saying? Like they're not. There's no characters in this movie that aren't interesting.
Yeah,
do you know what I'm saying? Yes, like everyone has a very like clear kind of way of doing it. And I could see other writers being more. Like writing, doing the same thing, providing like this is exactly who you are in the film, but the character may be just kind of bland, where the actor has to provide his own backstory so that he can add some interesting elements to it.
Yeah.
But these characters are just
and insane. all of them too, not just the main ones, but one of my favorite parts about this movie is all the little characters. Like my favorite, well, there's a couple. One of my favorite lines is when. They Gail and Evel stop at some like gas station after they've stolen Nathan Jr. Towards the end of the movie, and they stop off and I think it's Bill Forsyth is in there buying some balloons, and he's like, "These blow up into funny shapes," and the guy behind the counter is like, "Well, no, unless round is funny." Yeah. And he just but then there's that line, and then My favorite line, I think, or my favorite exchange in the whole movie.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this.
Is in the bank.
Yes.
When they come in and Jaggerman's like, everybody freeze, everybody down on the ground, and nobody moves. And then
the old timer.
And then the old timer goes, well, which one is it, feller? You want we should drop or freeze or get down on the ground? I'm trying to say it. It's like, because if I drop, or he says, wait.
If I freeze,
I can't rightly drop. But if when I drop, I'm going to be in motion. It's just like, that makes me so happy.
But then
that,
John Candy's face, where he's flustered. And then I love that the Coen brothers don't leave it at that. Yeah. When they get back in the car, the first thing John Candy says is, that old, whatever. God damn it.
It's fine. I'm going to dub in my voice going, Goodman.
Goodman. God damn it. All right. John Goodman. John Goodman gets back in the car and he says, wow, man, that old timer really threw me off my concentration. If he hadn't been there, we would have been
no
issues.
When everybody drops and he's like, shit, where all the tellers go? We're down here, sir. Like, dude, this movie is fucking brilliant. It just makes me happy how absurd it is. And
all right.
But it's got a lot of heart. It really does have a lot of heart to it. Like, and like, you know, in the end, I think it is kind of it's a beautiful story about this couple who, you know,
steal a baby.
They steal. Oh yeah. I mean, you know, if you can ignore the fact that but they bring it back. They bring the baby back. And very, very movie fashion, the Nathan Arizona lets them go without any, you know, repercussions, when in real life they'd be in prison for the rest of their lives.
Oh.
But there's a real, real heart to their relationship. And I like the way it resolves itself. I think it's actually kind of touching, despite how absurd it is. But I think that's because they intentionally made it with that kind of heart to it. It's just, this movie's like just a ray of sunshine. I don't know. I just, this, it makes me happy. It's a movie I watch to put me in. It's one of those few movies I watch to put me in, that puts me in a better mood.
All right.
No matter what.
I like that the story is almost as like, it's like, well, you can be a complete, kind of fuck up.
Yeah.
And just everything can kind of do what you can make a lot of mistakes, but you can still have, you know what I liked about it at the end is that the final sequence where, you know, he's having a dream and it's,
by the way, favorite last line of any movie, I think maybe ever,
I don't remember what the actual last line is.
And this, I've got a couple other contenders, but this one is, whenever I think about, like, it's my number one probably. And So Nick, yes, you're right. The movie ends with Nick Cage having this dream, imagining Nathan Jr. growing up to be happy and healthy and everything.
Right.
And he imagines, he sees this old couple who's clearly him and Holly Hunter, who have a bunch of their own kids now. And they're like it's just really beautiful. They're all gathered around for this big dinner. And Nick Cage says it was a place where all parents are strong and thoughtful or whatever, and all kids are happy and beloved. I don't know. Maybe it was Utah.
Yes. Okay, I remember the Utah. Yeah.
That gives me the tingles. It's so poetically perfect. Like, it is so, because it's so ridiculous.
Right.
It's so funny, but it's so, like, it's just, I mean, best, yeah, I think, I'm going to go ahead and say, I think best last line.
Okay, but so what I was getting at, and it's a great line, but what I was getting at, what I love about that end, was the visual. Because oftentimes in movies, when you go to this sappy kind of future scene where everybody loves everybody and gets together at the end of the, you know, world, and it's all great, is what I liked was that, okay, yes, they were still in the trailer.
Yeah, right.
And I liked that because it was like, it was like this whole family coming back to a trailer, which I think in most films, especially nowadays, well, this is a classic thing. It's like we haven't done Home Alone, but like there's this classic, how much did the Home Alone family make to live in that house? And I think in every house that you see, these people like are living in houses that you're just like, it's millions and millions of dollar houses that they can't afford, right? And so there's this, but they act like they're middle class or lower income people, right?
Yes.
So it's like you're watching, there's a dichotomy, but we just gobble it up. Sure. We're like, oh yeah, there's that person who works down at the factory.
Well, I've always maintained that, like, you know, like for me, the best example is Father of the Bride.
Yes.
Where that, it's like you watch that movie and you just feel like, oh, this is the most nice, like, it's like wholesome, like down to earth family ever. They're like fucking insanely
middle,
rich,
yeah, like they act like they're middle class, it's ridiculous. Like, yeah, but like, yeah, so it's like, oh, everyone, oh, I just got off my shift at the factory, you know, pulling levers, and I went into my 12 bedroom brick freaking colonial mansion, you know.
Yes.
It must have been left to them in the will from when they came over on the Mayflower, because it's like, that's the only way.
Yes.
Right? So what I love is at the end of this, they're just in a trailer, but they're happy.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what I like about it, is that it's like everyone there is happy. They're just like, so there's not this presumption that the dream isn't to be rich and wealthy.
Right.
The dream is to have, to be in the same trailer with the same person.
Yeah.
But to have this wonderful experience—that's the dream, and I like that choice.
Yeah, they really loved their characters.
Yes,
and like, and especially in, and I love, and I mean, all their movies. That's the thing that's most noteworthy about their movies is the characters. Every single one of them, the characters are always.
Yeah.
You could make a whole movie about every single.
Well, when we were talking about it, I mean, like the smaller characters, even like the couple that comes over.
Oh, Frances McDormand and Sam.
That's who it is.
Yeah, yes,
I didn't wreck. I was going to ask
who is
you.
Also the lead. Well, she's married to Joel Cohen and was the lead in Blood Simple.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And,
oh, I've
and,
never
you
seen
know,
Blood
Fargo,
Simple.
And she's in a bunch of their movies.
All right, but she was awesome, and you know, she's like, well, you've got to
gotta get his dip tit.
Gotta get
his dip tit, honey.
Yeah, that whole exchange. But I think what was frustrating me in that moment is like Holly Hunter is the one who gives freaking Nick Cage the idea to go steal this baby,
right?
And then they're sitting at the damn table, and she goes, "Have we done that, honey?" And it's like, "Well, of course he hasn't fucking done it. He just stole the damn baby.
I mean,
you've had the baby
again,
for a day."
In a lot of ways, I feel like it's just like it's a crash course in parenting.
Yeah,
for
but
these two.
But she's just,
yeah, I know,
did
it was her idea.
I know. I felt so bad for Nick Cage. Nick Cage is just staring at it like.
But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, as a father myself, that's just how you feel all the time.
Well,
anyway.
Okay.
We all feel like Nick Cage,
yeah,
totally ill-equipped to handle anything.
What? We have to do what? What are we doing? okay. Well, I don't have kids, so I will bow down to your experience. No, I love those characters and the lack of. The unfunniness of her husband, and what he says and what he thinks is funny.
Probably the only character in the movie who's like truly unlikable. Well,
yeah.
I guess the Leonard Smalls character, but
no, I actually
he's
didn't
even
find
more
him
likeable.
That funny. I didn't find him unlikable.
Really?
No, I didn't. I mean, I didn't think he was. He's not lovable in any way. Yeah. But I think he's. I don't know. I feel like he's a caricature. He's not. He's not as real. He's not like a real person.
Yeah, he's just obnoxious.
You know? The other guy. The
he's evil. He's meant to be a
Oh, and
monster.
So we talk about hold up. When, you know, whether these things hold up, and obviously this holds up. I think this movie holds up way better than some other movies we thought hold up, because I think it clearly is way ahead of its time, because there's a lot more movies like this.
Yeah, well, it's very influential. And
right.
If you look at the filmmakers who were influenced by it, it's a very long list.
And so I get the feeling, like, watching it, that you know, that it would be a very influential movie. But I think that it's I lost my train of thought. I'm just gonna stare off into the distance here.
That's fine. Right. I did want to just highlight before we wrap up that there are some phenomenal set pieces in this movie. Particularly,
the hand. Can I ask you a question? Because you're talking about this.
Yeah.
The hand. So nowadays, with like Jason Bourne, like the handheld camera type thing, and then I know in like True Detective, the McConaughey one, there was this long like 4 minute scene where it was a running take where they went in and out of all these buildings it's amazing.
Yeah.
They had not anything close to that long, but there was a scene where they're running the chase scene.
Yes,
right?
That's what I was going to talk
about. Okay, and it's handheld A lot. Some of this is handheld, where they're following him. Is that new at this point?
No, it's. I think. Well, it's Steadicam. A lot of it.
That's what I mean. Whatever.
Yeah, and that was. Well, that
don't get bogged down in my lack of knowledge. You need to know when I say something.
It's like 10 years old. It started in the '70s, but yeah. There's lots of the movie is shot really well. It's very lots of Steadicam, lots of I'm not sure if it's wide angle lenses or just some kind of a certain kind of lens that gives it a certain look. That kind of makes it more heightened and kind of comedic. But yeah, the camera work is very fast and very fluid, and it's always moving. But that scene in particular I wanted to highlight, because that chase scene is like a legendary. I think that's one of the it's one of the best foot chase scenes. I also think of Point Break has a great one.
Yeah.
And actually Seven has a really good one too, now I'm thinking about it. But this one in Raising Arizona, it's just because it's like the cartoon version of it's like French Connection but done cartoony. Like it's the same level of sophistication in the camera work and how fast and kind of exciting it feels, but it's done for maximum comedic effect, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it's unbelievable. It's just that set piece is just absolutely one of my favorite scenes just ever.
Right. No, it was great, and funny, he gets in that truck, and the guy's just screaming
Son,
constantly.
You got a panty on your head. Yeah. Another classic.
There's just, there's a lot of this. Yeah. It's a good movie. I'm warming up.
I mean,
to it.
You didn't not like it. You liked it. I believe that. The first time it was just a little. I think
it's jarring.
If you were to watch it again, you will go "Oh, this is great."
Yeah, I think that it's the cartoon thing is really is sticking with me, because it's like a Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner thing, and the Lewis the Smalls guy is kind of like the Tasmanian Devil,
right? Yeah.
And and it's a good movie. And the dialogue, I can't get over that. I was really listening to him write that letter to her. I was like, "Wow, man, that's great writing. That's amazing." I'm like, "How is she going to react to that?" And then he's like asleep on the, doesn't even give it to her, and she's gone already. And it's like, "Okay." All right. Well, what did Rod? Do we have what Roger thought?
I don't have. I'm off my game. I'm just gonna, because our trip to Cabo kind of threw me, so I haven't been fully back in the swing of things. So I don't have access to Roger's full review. I do, however, have a little snippet here.
All right, well, let's give a snippet,
which is surprising.
Is it?
Yes. Okay, I mean, although maybe in context, not as. But this is the little. It's just a little snippet on, and I'm just quoting from Wikipedia. I apologize. For my lack of research here. But anyway, Roger Ebert wrote a negative review of the film. I don't have the star rating, so I don't know how many stars. But he wrote a negative review stating that the film stretches out every moment for more than it's worth, until even the moments of inspiration seem forced. Since the basic idea of the movie is a good one and there are talented people in the cast, what we have here is a film shot down by its own forced and mannered style.
Well, which, Roger.
I mean,
he's a processor.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I will say is like I was saying before about Nick Cage, is that this was early and people just weren't prepared for the Coen brothers, and they didn't know. Like, I can imagine being a film critic and loving Blood Simple and going like, "Oh man, I can't wait to see what they do next." And then they do this, and it's like, "What the hell is this?" So maybe there's a little bit of that, but still disappointing. Because I mean, just even to not recognize just how fucking hilarious and smart it was in the writing, at least. Like, I mean,
well,
it's kind of
like you said, if it's ahead of its time, sometimes it can feel a little. I mean, like I think I've said this on this podcast before, but I was trying to read. Don Quixote, and Don Quixote is like considered a lot of times as like the first modern novel,
right?
And so like I'm reading it, and I'm like, I don't really like this. It's like kind of really bad, blah blah blah. And then I realize, like, I'm thinking like, well, this is like the first version of this style, which then grew into what felt like to me like just bad versions of that. Is really just the beta version of it ever being done. And I think that happens when you watch a movie or anything that is its first iteration of it, yeah. it can sometimes be like, what the hell is this? And it doesn't feel like what the more distilled versions are later after years and years of perfecting the you know, the technique or yeah. style or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like you have to always be put it in context of like, is this the first or is this not?
Right.
So
yeah, I can see how this would have just been. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I think we're both in agreement for Raising Arizona, I believe.
Yeah. Two nuns up. Two I nuns mean, it's, up. It's two nuns up. I think that, I like the movie a lot more having after talked to you about it. Yeah. I mean, I coming into this, I was kind of like, eh. I was like, you know, it was good and whatnot, but I don't know if it was, you know, everything that Matt was saying it was, but now having talked it out with you, I'm feeling a little more positive about it. So yeah, definitely two nuns up.
Yeah, I highly recommend. Raising Arizona is one of those movies I feel comfortable recommending to pretty much anybody. It's one of the few movies that I feel like I would recommend it to just about anybody. Like, it's just a great comedy, and it's, you know, I mean, even we were just talking to our parents, you know, even my parents like Raising Arizona, which yeah. is like, that's
it's saying something.
It is.
Yeah, it's
we
it's,
rarely meet eye to eye on movies.
On movies, but
they even they enjoyed it. So
yeah. I mean, look, it's visually very in fun, and yeah, it's a good movie. Two nuns up.
No nuns in the movie.
All right. Well, I don't know that there's anything else to say. Are we going to do another one or what?
Well, we're. Should we
reveal
tease the next
one? All right.
We're so for the next film, we will be doing. A kind of random choice, but from our youth, not really. Not I'd say from our youth, but not really, because I only saw this movie once.
Well, Matt, reminding everyone, we're here in Murphy, North Carolina. This is the place where the box, the cabin in the
That's
woods.
True, where the toy originated.
The toy originated from the box in the cabin in the woods, and we're in the cabin.
We're in Matt. This is our choices. We're doing this as if our choices are limited to the VHSs that our parents had
that are in the cabin.
That are in the woods. Cabin in the woods, and one of those movies happens to be the 1991 classic Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yes.
Starring the most Englishman that ever lived, Kevin Costner.
Yeah, nothing, you know, it's funny. When was Untouchables?
87.
Okay, so I think what's happened here, I'm going to just tell you, what's happened here is that Kevin Costner has taken thinks he's Sean Connery is what's happened, okay? Because Sean Connery never does an accent, ever, ever. It's just he's got his voice and that's it.
Right.
And doesn't matter where he's at. He could be a samurai in ancient Japan.
Yes.
And he would have his Scottish accent.
Problematic casting, but okay.
But yes, but he would have his Scottish accent. There's no attempt by Sean Connery. Yes. And I think this got into Kevin Costner's head a little bit.
Yeah. I think truly,
well, we don't need to talk about
we're
it.
Gonna, we're going to save it. We're going to save it. But boy, oh boy, one of the most baffling character casting choices that has ever happened.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. We're gonna.
It's gonna be a doozy.
All right. Well,
it's gonna be a doozy.
Matt,
thank you.
It's good to be back.
It's nice to see you. Well, we've seen each other for the past 2.5 months in Cabo. It's nice, but it's nice to be back on the mic, so to speak. And well, not so to speak. I actually am on the mic,
and we're back here in the cabin in the woods.
We're gonna try to get back to our routine, or maybe not. Maybe we'll take another 2 months off. It's our fucking podcast. We'll do whatever we want.
But the attempt as of today is to continue the schedule.
So you can be consistent for you folks
out there. Yeah. So all right, Matt, another one in the books.
Yep.
You want to give it?
You know, I am just. Thank you for listening, and good day.